thank everybody.
Okay.
I wanted to thank everybody for being on here and let you know we do have a number of our team members on, and the congressman will be hopping on in just a moment. I know a couple of folks are still working to unmute, but we are ready to get going whenever you are.
Okay. And, you know, I'll just start. Most folks on the call may be familiar with CoLabs, and I may have met you in the past at one of our on-site lab tours. But I am Dan Powers, the executive director of CoLabs. We are a nonprofit consortium of federally funded research laboratories and joint research institutes on university campuses in Colorado. And our broader network includes economic development organizations and technology companies of all different types, academic organizations and colleges. And our mission is to champion the impact of federally funded research here in the state as not only an asset to Colorado's economy, but to our nation's economy and our nation's national security. So as much as we can do to nurture this ecosystem, one of the ways we do that is to host tours, but COVID has really put that off the table as an option. So we're doing it digitally. We look to connect people who need to know what is going on in these labs for their own ability to manifest that, whether it might be through a company or some other kind of partnership. And that realm of technology transfer is very important. And then the other realm of our activity is helping make sure our elected officials know what is going on and that we help their questions be answered as to exactly what are priority projects and what are the capabilities of these federally funded research labs in Colorado. With that, we've framed this call today to give these quick overviews from several prominent research entities that are here in Colorado that you'll be hearing from. You can find more information, the links to each of these entities, on our website or in that agenda that I sent out to everyone. And if you're interested in connecting specifically with a particular lab or finding out what particular kind of science may be researched here in Colorado, please reach me directly, and I'd be happy to play that vector role and get you connected to the right person. And otherwise, perhaps I'll hand it to you, Sally or Jill, if you would like to speak also about the context of what Representative Neguse had in mind for the call, and we'll fill the time a little bit until he's actually on the call.
Great, and I know we've got our Environmental Legislative Director, Chris Abungi, on the call as well. I'll let Carissa chime in too, and then let's see. Rep. Neguse, are you on? I know he was just about to join and was working to unmute.
And I guess we'll let him proudly announce himself when he is on the call.
This is Sally from the Congressman's team. I'm happy to kind of just chat through, I think, what would be helpful for us and for the Congressman on this call, especially as, you know, as many of you have seen, we are diving into another COVID relief package. I think it'll be the first of two. And so just kind of hearing from you all as far as the challenges you have faced and as far as COVID goes and how we can be helpful in advocating for the federal labs. But also just as a forward looking, as Dan was mentioning, of this is really an opportunity for us to think through possible policy and legislation, and I'll let Carissa hop in too on this. But I think we're just, with these calls, it's always really helpful for us to hear your ideas. You know, I know the Congressman is a big believer that the best ideas come directly from the state and from the district and from you all. So I think that would be a big goal of ours for this call today.
Great. Thanks,
Sally. Yeah, hi. This is Carissa Abungi, the Congressman's legislative assistant here in D.C., covering all things science and environment, and just want to say thank you to everyone that's on the call and, you know, all of the fabulous labs and universities and institutions in the district. We're just really excited about the 117th Congress. And all of the new legislative opportunities that we'll have. And, you know, we're just all ears as far as legislative proposals go. We want to hear your ideas and, you know, be as helpful as possible. So Just really excited to hear everyone's remarks, and just really excited. So thanks for having us.
Thanks, Krista. This is Dan Powers with CoLabs. I'm curious if you might frame what Representative Goose has taken as some either priority or just context for some of his work in this next Congress, born of the executive orders issued by the Biden administration around climate change or other topics. That might be some helpful context for the lab directors and scientists to understand how Joe is seeing that.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, we've seen a number of the executive orders just in the last couple of weeks, including the executive order on scientific integrity. The congressman is an original sponsor on Mr. Tonko's Scientific Integrity Act. So we are really, really excited about that bill and excited to get it done this Congress. So, I mean, I think that's definitely top of mind. And in addition to that, just generally funding for science. You know, the congressman has been a leader in terms of leading appropriations bills, or excuse me, letters to advocate for all the federal labs and institutions and districts. So that's going to be a top priority again. And like I said, I mean, I think that we have maybe a bit of a more friendly audience this Congress in terms of making sure that a lot of those programs get funded and making sure that we're protecting scientists and particularly, you know, climate science. So, yeah, I think that those couple of things come to mind immediately. And in addition to that, implementing a lot of the recommendations that we laid out in the report through the Select Committee on the Climate Crisis. There's a lot of legislative ideas in there. And so I think we'll be working on that in the coming years with the Select Committee.
And Dan, I just heard from the congressman that he'd love if we went ahead and got started, and he'll be on shortly, but we don't want to take up too much more time waiting. And of course, you've got a whole team of folks here taking notes. And
okay. Well, if you'd like, then we could get started, and we'll be making materials available to Representative Neguse's staff, and also look to share with him not only this call, but some of the particular details that I've received offline from the different labs that they think would inform his stated goals already, as Carissa was just describing, and some of the other resolutions and legislation that he's introduced that have a connection to the scientific research efforts here in the country.
And hello, Dan. This is Joe. I'm not sure if you all can hear me. Just joined the call. My apologies. We just had votes, so I'm running back to my office here now. But my apologies. I did caught the end of Carissa's update, and looking forward to hearing from each of you about your respective priorities for the next calendar year and the 117th Congress. Of course, it'll be a very busy 2 years here in Washington. I'm very excited to work with each of you on our common priorities. And, of course, goes without saying, but nonetheless, can't be stated enough how much we appreciate all the work that each of you are doing at your respective labs for our country. So with that, I'll turn it back over to you, Dan, and then happy to answer any questions as we go through.
Okay. Thank you, Congressman. I think the nomination hearings last week with the Department of, or the Secretary of Commerce and Secretary of Energy really informed much of the vision that we see from the Biden administration on where the country should go and the implied, if not explicit, directives to research priorities for federal research laboratories across the country were really staunch and actually very exciting because their connections to what's happening in Colorado, I think, are, again, explicit and dramatic, the impact of what our labs here in Colorado could do for these goals across the country is something we're proud of, but also want to make sure we have on your radar. Let's then move into the agenda, and we'll start with Dr. Tony Busalaki and then into Everett Joseph, who are speaking from UCAR and NCAR. And if you would like to give just a quick brief overview of your organization, that's fine, but let's move into your priorities as you would like to discuss them. To you, Tony.
Dan, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, very good. So, Congressman, first of all, thanks for your time and your staff's time and your continued leadership in areas such as the Climate Crisis Committee. Before I start, I want to revisit a prior conversation about the COVID impact to date on facilities such as UCAR. And we've calculated that over the last 11 months, the dollar impact to UCAR has been about $2.8 million due to COVID. Now, as for today, as you may well know, the University Corporation for Atmospheric Research represents 120 member colleges and universities. And in a transition document for the new administration and the 117th Congress, we've set forth a set of research priorities for the atmospheric, oceanic, earth, and related sciences. And this transition document focuses on the challenges and importance of investing in the following priority areas: weather, water, climate, air quality, space weather, and education, whereby strategic investments in these areas will help the nation enter a new age of prediction based on a increasingly sophisticated understanding of the interconnected aspect of the Earth as a coupled system. And so by investigating the atmosphere, ocean, land, and cryosphere as a coupled system, our scientists are laying the groundwork for more accurate predictions across a range of time and space scales to better help society prepare for threats, ranging from lightning strikes that may hit a military test range within hours to unusually cold and wet weather patterns that may affect the continental region over the next decade. Now, advances in these areas rely on three research components that are foundational to Earth system science. One, detailed space-based and in-situ observations. Two, computer models that simulate complex processes. And three, data simulation that enables our scientists to incorporate the observational data into the models. So strengthening the nation's forecasting capabilities is going to require investments that are appropriate in each of these foundational technologies. In evaluating the effectiveness and resource needs of federal efforts in each of these three research components, three family of questions need to be asked. One, with respect to observations, what gaps exist in the current system of observations that are impediments to achieving greater predictive capability? And what are the relevant decision trades needed between ground-based and space-based platforms to overcome these gaps? Two, with respect to our modeling, how reliable are our existing predictive models? What are the shortcomings in our models, for example, in the U.S. versus the European weather models? And are our organizational approaches appropriate to dealing with them? And so what steps are needed to improve them within a four-year period identified in a way that can be measured by the research community, policymakers, and the public? And third, data simulation. What are the systems used and needed to bring together our observations in models, inclusive of the needed high-performance computing? And what percentage of existing high-quality data are being used and uptaked by our models to provide decision support systems, but with demonstrable impact? And so bottom line, are we getting the best bang for our buck? So quickly, in terms of weather, the benefit of investing in improved weather forecasts and warnings is obviously substantial. It's been estimated that the annualized benefit is about $31.5 billion compared to the $5 billion spent annually by the federal government for generating baseline information. With respect to water, events in recent years include record-breaking drought and associated wildfires in the West, severe flooding in the Great Plains and Southeast, and then issues with respect to infrastructure and lead-contaminated water that have focused attention on the state of our nation's water's quality, resources, and infrastructure. And so a complete understanding of the water system requires an approach that extends beyond the atmosphere to include links among the Earth's water system, climate change, land use, population, demographics, and ecosystems. Climate, what else needs to be said? That climate change is already having major impacts in the U.S. across the world via heat waves, extended droughts, wildfires, migration of disease-carrying insects, coastal flooding, and other events. So research goals that would more effectively inform the response to climate change include better understanding of the interacting physical, chemical, biological, and societal components of the Earth system, the vulnerability and resilience of its natural and human dimensions, and the potential to use technology to remove carbon from the atmosphere or artificially cool the planet. And so to conclude, in terms of, you know, specific asks, we, of course, are very interested in raising the top-line budget at the National Science Foundation. And there's now talk being supported by both sides of the aisle on an organic act for NOAA. And so that, with that, I will close. Thank you for your time and your support, and I will turn it to my colleague, Everett Joseph, the director of NCAR. So thank you again, Joe.
Well, thank you, Tony. Always a pleasure, and thank you for that very informative update.
Thanks, Tony, and thanks, Dan, and good afternoon, Congressman and colleagues. I really appreciate the opportunity to participate in this meeting to update you on the work taking place at NCAR. What I'm going to do is build on Tony's presentation a little bit. One, just a quick introduction of NCAR. We'd be remiss if I didn't do that, and then talk about what's new. Give some a few examples of what we're doing that's important to Coloradans, and then end with some what we think a role for this federal government in terms of really helping us to do basic research. So just a quick introduction, NCAR is the National Science Foundation's largest federally funded research and development center. Most of our funding comes from NSF. Additional investments come from partnerships with other agencies. The research we do, just to remind everyone, really goes beyond the atmosphere that's in our title. We study the ocean, land, ice sheets, the sun and its influences on the Earth, such as space weather. To understand one part of the system, and this is an important part of our message, how that evolves, how that's influenced by human activity, how it influences human activity. It's really important to understand all parts of the system and how they interact. As such, multidisciplinary staff of scientists work at NCAR, including meteorologists, climate scientists, hydrologists, oceanographers, solar physicists, social scientists, and ecologists. And we work with other professionals in Colorado under one roof to really take on some of the most serious environmental challenges of our time. So understanding the Earth as a system, which is novel, is critical to developing solutions to these difficult environmental challenges of poor air quality, climate, weather change, space weather, and their impacts on society. I'm really excited to share that we have developed a new strategic plan that focuses our research and what we call actionable Earth system science. And this plan is designed to make us more intentional and strategic about targeting our basic research to yield results that translate into useful and actionable information for the benefit of the public. A key part of this is conducting more interdisciplinary research, being intentional in that sense, and also building partnerships with stakeholders in government, private sector, academia, and working with them in new innovative ways to amplify the benefits of our research to society. So just to take a few more minutes to share with you a few of the examples of how our work and our science that we do continue to support the citizens of Colorado. Water resources is a good example. As you know, the agricultural industry and municipalities in Colorado rely on data about stream flow forecasting and upcoming water availability so they can have some advanced understanding of what their water allocation would be. This data comes from models that we develop in partnership with our partners at the National Weather Service. Snowpack is another example. The tourism industry in Colorado obviously cares a lot about snowpack. our research helps to provide more useful information on how snowpack will change in the future. And even more urgent example is wildfire. And once again, as we all know, a wildfire threatened Coloradans in districts like yours and others in this past fire season in 2020. At NCAR, we're working directly with the state of Colorado to provide state-of-the-art fire behavior forecasting. But let's drill down, just to drill down a little bit more to understand the challenge in that regard. The goal is real-time prediction of wildfire behavior to inform firefighting efforts. We use sophisticated fire behavior models to make these predictions. These models take into account hyper-local weather conditions that affect the fire, the available fuel on the ground, the amount of moisture in the fuel, the combustion patterns of different types of fuels, and topography. Getting up-to-date, near real-time data of this kind, again, at a hyper-local level, and blending that into the model is currently a limitation on fire behavior prediction and in need of more research. Understanding how the fire affects weather is important, but also how the weather, and not just how the weather affects the fire, is very important. And it's a complicated interaction, and it's also complicated to represent in our models. And this needs more research as well. And finally, also equally important, the fire behavior forecast is only as good as the way it's communicated. I like to say that in the past, historically, as scientists and meteorologists, we used to throw forecasts over the fence to emergency responders and keep our fingers crossed that it is helpful to them. The focus now of research and partnership, the focus now is on providing forecast information in ways that is actionable to first responders. It has to be conveyed in terms that are understood by first responders and, for example, carry information about risk. Developing the tools and the methods to do this in a consistent basis for every fire requires research collaboration among atmospheric scientists, data scientists, social scientists, experts in public safety, and really requires more effort. Just to end and to provide a broader strategic perspective and 30,000 foot view, the big challenge we face is really breaking down stovepipes to form effective partnerships that really enable us to tackle these problems in a really intelligent and innovative way. These partnerships are important to help us understand the problem and what information is needed by decision makers to take action. This understanding helps us to set scientific requirements, and the partnerships give us access to experts from different fields to co-design the research. With wildfire, this is particularly challenging because the expertise to solve different parts of this puzzle of making better fire behavior forecasts is spread across different parts of the scientific community and different federal agencies where communication and collaboration can sometimes be difficult. So in cases like this, the federal government can really be a help and create momentum in breaking down these stovepipes and barriers with rules and incentives to form, and, for example, operate research test beds as an example, where different agencies or industry or academia can come together to co-design innovative solutions. So I'll stop there, and I'm happy to sort of engage in more discussion on this. I really thank you for your interest, your support, and your partnership. And again, looking forward to more dialogue and working with the broader science community to support these and so many other scientific efforts. Really, that's focused on protecting life and property of America, of the American people.
Okay. This is Dan with CoLabs. Thank you, Everett. Thank you very much. Next, we want to hear from Chris McKay with the National Ecological Observatory Network.
Thanks a lot, Dan, and good afternoon, Representative Goose and your staff. I'm Chris McKay. I'm the operations manager for the National Ecological Observatory Network. It's also known as NEON. And NEON, like NCAR, is one of the National Science Foundation's large research infrastructures. Additionally, we have on the line our NEON Observatory Director, Dr. Paula Mabee. She's also here and will be available to unmute if there's any questions that she needs to address. We really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and your staff today about some of the research our scientists are supporting related to changes in the climate. As you may know, NEON's mission is to collect and to make available ecological data that allow scientists to understand how the U.S. ecosystems are changing. And we do this through data collection at 81 sites all across America. And we're in the very first few years of what is planned to be a 30-year program. So we have essentially 181 data products. They cover everything in the ecosystem, including atmospheric measurements, soil, plants, animals, disease, water, and the remote sensing of the ecosystems from planes. So this data has a lot of applications to things like climate change, food and water security, inputs for forecasting models, and other things that inform public policy decisions. So like the other research organizations represented here today, we are still dealing with the effects of COVID safety precautions on the operations of our teams and our labs. We do continue to operate throughout the pandemic, although we have had some effects on the amount of, and the frequency of the field work we can do. The major effects over the last year from COVID have been some of the data gaps as COVID incidence has increased in parts of the country where we operate. We've also had to limit the amount of the airborne remote sensing collection to areas in the country that are near to our base in Colorado to make it safe for our operators and our people that support that. In addition to collecting data for the NEON program, which is our primary mission, I'm going to talk a little bit today about some of the collaborations we're doing with other research teams on data application and extending the reach of ecological data. And one of the first things I like to talk about is collaboration with our Boulder neighbors and friends at NCAR. We just heard from Dr. Joseph about what they're doing. So NSF has recently funded a joint effort between our two organizations to enable some the linkage of some of the NEON data into NCAR's climate models. And this collaboration expands both organizations' science data output, and it enables data inputs from the wide range of ecosystems where we already have instrumentation into their models. And it also provides model outputs back to our users so they can use some of the climate modeling that NCAR can provide directly with the existing publicly available data sets from NEON. We're also doing work with researchers from universities in the Colorado Air Front Range area and across the nation, and assisting them in adding new sensors and performing extra data collection at existing sites that we operate. And this program is opening up the NEON infrastructure so that other researchers can expand the reach of the observatory and help those scientists answer questions on important things like ecosystem changes and the relationship between satellite measurements and ground level processes. And like Dr. Joseph mentioned, some of the important things that are happening in our environment right now, like wildfires and floods, those disturbances can quickly be addressed and data collected on the recovery and what happened in those areas. And then there's a third item I think you may be interested in, and that's some of the support for Arctic research. The rapid changes in the Arctic are having far-reaching effects on things like carbon dioxide levels, sea level rise, and even things like national security issues as the Arctic waters become more navigable. Our team supports the NSF's logistics for Arctic research, and one of the things we did recently was work on enabling COVID testing in Greenland, where a lot of that research for the Arctic happens, so that the teams of scientists can get there and do their work research safely at the U.S. facilities that are there. We've supplied the PCR equipment and some of the associated supplies that will be used not only for the researchers that are going to Greenland to do the important climate research, but also the Air National Guard members that transport them there and operate the bases that they go in and out of the country on. So I'm going to kind of end there. Thanks so much for your time. If you or your staff have any questions, we're always available to engage with you, and look forward to talking to you later. Thanks a lot.
Great. Thank you very much, Chris. All right, and thanks, everyone, for staying concise. I know time is going by quickly, and I'll be looking to add any follow-up information onto our website, as I mentioned, from any of the speakers. So please know that we can add on to this conversation afterwards that way online. Next, we'll go to Chris Kumerow with the CSU Cooperative Institute for Research in the Atmosphere. Over to you, Chris.
Yeah, good afternoon, everyone. Congressman Neguse, it's a pleasure to be here. So I am Chris Kumerow. I'm the director of the Cooperative Institute for Research in the Atmosphere, which is a NOAA Cooperative Institute essentially designed to bring in the university into the NOAA research. Our mission is sort of particularly set in that we are split between the NESDES line office with satellite observations and OAR, which is the Atmospheric and Oceanic Research. In fact, we sort of bring a unique perspective to this whole thing. And so I can, first of all, you know, if you're sort of interested, one of the things that we do is a lot of imagery used by forecasters as well as the general public. I, you know, direct you to CIRA webpage, which is easy enough to find, CIRA at Colorado State. There's some, you know, fantastic imagery there. But really the satellite observations that we do sort of splits in two directions. One of them is the creation of climate data records, particularly for us in the areas of water vapor, clouds, and precipitation. And this is really aimed at, you know, providing long, you know, homogeneous records to really see what is happening, you know, on the planet. And these climate data records are always more complicated than one thinks. We've been working at it for a long time. In addition to the water vapor, clouds, and precipitation, we're also developing the algorithms for CO2. There, we also need, you know, higher resolution space and time to sort of really see where CO2 is being generated and where it's going. Interestingly enough, we still don't have a complete account of all the CO2 in terms of where it's ending up. There's more being absorbed by the system than we currently can really account for. So that work with just the satellite data is a lot of what we do. We also in that are working very closely with NOAA from the, you know, NOAA has both climate and weather responsibilities. And we really want to make sure that the weather satellites that are currently flying and are being planned as we speak, you know, have the capability of meeting both the weather and the climate goals. You know, you need a certain amount of stability to be able to use satellites for climate, you know, records. And to make sure that this is really happening is also sort of a great interest to us and I think that the nation. So we also then, you know, use that satellite data to work with the modeling community, in particular with a global systems lab down in Boulder. And there, you know, one of their, you know, big efforts at the moment is that one-hour forecast that actually assimilates ground-based radar data on an hourly basis. And I just wanted to bring that up, you know, because it's a sort of a perfect example of where graduate students here have recently finished work to sort of simulate radar data over the Gulf of Mexico and the adjacent waters using satellite data. So it's not real radar data, but you can simulate that, and it was done largely with new machine learning, artificial intelligence methods. That's been another focus of our university here. So we're using a lot of AI, in particular explainable AI, so that, you know, it's not only a black box, but we also know what the black box is doing inside and why it's making decisions to expand our ability to model, to bring in information from the continental United States and expand that to a global set. And here I sort of want to echo what I think what both Tony and Everett sort of said before me. There's a lot of stovepipes in the science field, and I think the federal government can really help by eliminating or at least funding work in between those stovepipes to allow us, for instance, to use more satellite data in the models. And at the moment, it's very difficult, and we're actually running behind some of the other, the European Center, for instance, in being able to assimilate as much of the data as we can. And it's because of some of these stovepipes. So other than that, I think I just sort of wanted to end here by sort of saying that, the cooperative institutes are really, a good way to that Colorado has by having two out of the 16 cooperative institutes of NOAA to really take the university research and really put that into the weather enterprise and going all the way from academic research to operations, which is always a difficult thing to do. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Well, that's a good segue then into Margaret Tolbert is here from the Cooperative Institute for Research and Environmental Sciences, the joint institute at CU Boulder. Over to you, Margaret.
Okay, great. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. Well, first, I'd like to thank Representative McGoose and his staff for the opportunity to speak and also for your support of the university and science and the role of science in decision-making. But first, just to introduce myself, I'm a faculty member in the chemistry department at CU Boulder, and I've been a fellow at CU for over 25 years and have graduated almost 40 PhD students doing their research in my lab at CU. And CU, just on a personal level, has been a great home to them, giving them just lots of opportunities for impactful science and collaborations, and I'm very grateful to be a part of CERES. But today, I'd like to put on my associate director hat and talk to you more broadly about CERES on behalf of the director, Waleed Abdulati, who couldn't be here today, unfortunately. So CERES, and as you said, it's the Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences. It's a partnership between NOAA and CU Boulder, and we have about 900 people, including about 200 students. And roughly half of those people are embedded in the NOAA labs here in Boulder, and their work is essential to the scientific success of NOAA. And conversely, the CERES connection with NOAA allows unique educational opportunities for our students to be involved in more mission-related research. And so it's really a great two-way partnership that's producing world-class science and educational opportunities. Today, I just want to highlight a few high-impact projects in the area of climate change and extreme weather that some of our CERES scientists and students are involved in. And so first, extreme weather. Our CERES researchers help build the weather models, including the severe storm forecast models that help the National Weather Service anticipate storms like the massive storm that pummeled the U.S. East Coast earlier this week. And in fact, one of the tools that we've helped develop just went operational this month. It's the Winter Storm Severity Index, and I've sent over the website for that tool for you to check out. And if you do, you'll see Colorado's in the clear for the next few days, so that's some good news. CERES people are also critical to the better forecast atmospheric rivers, like the one that occurred last week in California, record rainfall, and that created massive mudslides that washed out Highway 1. And I've also sent over a slide describing our research effort on atmospheric rivers. And these rivers have a far reach and can impact snowfall even here in Colorado. Another focus area for CERES is in the area of climate change. We have lots going on in climate change, ranging from fundamental lab studies performed primarily by students to larger chamber studies to long-term monitoring of greenhouse gas concentrations around the world to massive international field campaigns. And I'd like to mention one campaign that just finished up in the Arctic, Mosaic, and that was an international expedition that was co-led by a Ceres researcher, and it was a big mission with over 30 countries and 500 scientists, with the U.S. side mostly funded by the National Science Foundation. And I sent over a photo from Mosaic that was selected as one of Nature Magazine's top 10 science images of the year, so that was really neat. Ceres researchers are also involved in other Arctic climate research, including ice forecasting for the Navy, helping indigenous communities deal with Arctic climate change, as well as modeling the connections between Arctic climate change and changing weather patterns closer to home. The final research area that I wanted to touch on is our work on wildfires, which is a topic that is very near and dear to the hearts of Coloradans who experienced this threat so strongly last summer. Ceres scientists embedded at NOAA were involved in the development of a new NOAA tool to forecast smoke, and that's called HER smoke, that just went operational. And I sent over the link for that new tool showing last summer's wildfire smoke. And the tool's a bit tricky to use, so if you're interested in using it, just let us know and we can help you learn more about it. We're also involved in field campaigns to study air quality impact of smoke from fires in the western U.S., and one such large project just finished up, FireX AQ, and that was to study the air quality impact of fires, and that involved, among others, NOAA and Ceres and students from the CU Chemistry Department, and this is just another example of how Ceres enables this extraordinary teaching opportunities in the field for our students by connecting them with this mission-oriented research. And finally, I wanted to mention Ceres is also conducting research on the connections between fires and climate change. So in closing, I just want to say that I'm really honored to be part of Ceres and the great work we're doing both in service to society and in educating the next generation of scientists. And I thank you for giving me the time to speak today.
Great. Thank you very much, Margaret. And yes, I put these slides up on our website already in that news link. Segueing right over to David Fahey with NOAA's Earth Systems Research Laboratory. David, to you.
Yeah, thank you, Dan. Congressman Nagus and staff, thank you for setting this up today. It's a pleasure to talk to you again. I represent Earth System Research Laboratories, which is composed of four individual laboratories that you visited in the past. We conduct globally significant long-term atmospheric observations and monitoring essential to understanding the climate system and weather, the topics today. And following Dr. Tolbert, I want to not overlook emphasizing our outstanding relationship with Ceres in this cooperative arrangement. As Dr. Tolbert pointed out, there are some of the highlights of our joint research. And so their contribution to the work I'll talk about today is essential. So I'll just quickly go through the four different labs and give you a highlight, starting with the Global Monitoring Lab that monitors greenhouse gases, aerosols, stratospheric ozone, for example, around the world continually. Given the president's new climate fact sheet and new emphasis on climate, this work, that meaning monitoring greenhouse gases in particular, will be increasingly important to track baseline greenhouse gas concentrations and the effectiveness of the actions taken to meet the Paris Agreement, which we just rejoined. So GML really provides a drumbeat of observations of the principal gases that we're interested in. Next week, two important papers will appear in the leading journal Nature that show results for how unreported global emissions of CFC-11, a principal ozone-depleting substance that's fully banned now, how those emissions have subsided over the last 2 years. This is a good news story. A few years ago, the same NOAA group lab reported substantial emissions increasing in the atmosphere from Asia, which is the first known violation of the Montreal Protocol, which set off years of discussion and action and introspection in the protocol that that led to this subsiding emissions. So it's a testament to the value of the vigilance that NOAA can provide for the world. You'll also find the Kigali Amendment in President Biden's fact sheet. That's one of his objectives. And if you look into the foundation, scientific foundation of the Kigali Amendment, it will bring you to this lab. And that's one of our themes, is providing scientific foundational scientific information to decision makers. The Chemical Sciences Lab is the lab I run, conducts research to understand processes related to atmospheric composition and the impacts of those of changes in composition on three fronts: climate, air quality, and the stratosphere. What's new for us in the, that might be of interest is that our lab is leading the OAR Earth Radiation Budget Initiative, which is intended to evaluate the role of aerosol processes in the stratosphere and aerosol cloud processes in the marine clouds in the lower atmosphere by acquiring new observations and using regional and global models. So these are directed funds from Congress that recognizes that there may come a day when we may want to inject aerosol into the atmosphere on a sufficient scale to temporarily offset climate. And in preparation, they've asked us to go make sure we understand the systems that we might perturb. In the Physical Sciences Laboratory, they do research to observe, understand, model, and predict weather and climate extremes and their impacts, with a focus on flooding and drought events, which are quite relevant to the country. One high visibility activity that's new is the Advanced Quantitative Precipitation Information Project, or AQPI, which is developing a new state-of-the-art precipitation and flooding prediction system targeting the nine Bay Area counties. So this has been a long time coming. A new radar network will be built as part of this initiative, actually by CSU, and Chris Kumaro's staff may be involved, that will feed high-resolution severe weather models and NOAA's national water model to give decision-makers better early warning and more accurate estimates of rainfall, runoff, and flooding, to help them manage impacts of atmospheric river events, which get a lot of notable coverage in the press. So NOAA undertook the AQPI project in response to a specific call for help from California officials after a $20 million bond issue was passed there. So here's our stakeholder involvement, that we're called upon by states and other entities to use our expertise to address these problems. The Global Systems Lab has come up already in this call, is one of several of OAR labs that pursue R&D research for the National Weather Service. And actually, as Dr. Tolbert mentioned just now, that GSL has successfully transitioned two significant model upgrades to the National Weather Service, and this rapid refresh and HRRR, or the HRR model, the High Resolution Rapid Refresh. These are probably acronyms that you've heard before, that improve the performance of what are already the best short-term rapid refreshing numerical weather prediction models in operation in the world. That's a key phrase, the best short-term rapid refreshing numerical weather prediction models in operation. And they're quite impressive, even for the uninitiated. Among other things, the upgrades include this operational HRR smoke model that Dr. Tolbert mentioned, which improves forecast guidance for air quality impacts from things like dust from the Sahara Desert as well as wildfire. And those of us in Boulder, in particular this summer, saw the sun darkened in August from local fires. And I, for one, was using the HRR smoke model every day for weeks there, wondering, you look out your window and that's a thick cloud. Is it going to be there at 9 o'clock? Where is it coming from, et cetera? And so many people are using this model, which is now operational. And GSL, Global Systems Lab, is involved in the AQPI project to ingest this new information from this new radar network. So there's a lot of, we're not stovepiped in this way, that we're working across laboratory boundaries and sharing in how these sophisticated tools come into being and then are used. And so I'll end with a comment about COVID-19, that yes, indeed, it's impacted essentially every research institution, and it's impacted this building, which has 850 people in it, 550 in OAR. But I must say we're doing extremely well under the circumstances. We have quite a lot of activity going on in the building in a very safe mode. Teleworking is maximized, and we're able to continue moving towards our mission goals like we would on normal times. But there are some real casualties. We've delayed major field missions, several of them, that simply are irreplaceable, and we push them off into the future and hope to regroup. So, Congressman, thank you very much for your attention. Your office has been very receptive to the science from this building.
Okay, thank you, David. And now we're going to switch gears into some advanced digital communication technology discussion. And both Marla and Andy, I hope you'll be able to stay just a couple minutes longer. I want to be sure you each have at least 5 minutes. And Jill, Sally, Carissa, if you're able to stay on the call, and others who are on the call, know that we will continue this at least for a few minutes over, because hearing from both Marla and Andy on what their research is about, I think will keep you compelled, and it's necessary to hear their details. So, Marla, over to you.
Great. Thanks a lot, Dan. So I'm Marla Dowell. I'm director of the NIST Communications Technology Laboratory and NIST Boulder Laboratory. Our mission is to advance connectivity, enhance performance, grow our economy, and improve lives. NIST DTL knows that the resiliency of the American workforce and our schools depend on trusted communication systems now more than ever. That need drove our team to work through the challenges of the global pandemic to do our part to drive innovation for our economy. An example of our perseverance is we just finished building another state-of-the-art facility, the 5G coexistence testbed, which applies the newest generation end-to-end 5G millimeter wave LTE laboratory. The techniques and metrology derived from this testbed will have applications in everyday wireless communications, IoT, and 5G networks. NIST is host to the National Advanced Spectrum and Communications Test Network, or NASTEN, a multi-agency chartered partnership that organizes a national network of federal, academic, and commercial test facilities. NASTEN provides testing, modeling, and analysis necessary to develop and deploy spectrum sharing technologies and inform future spectrum policy and regulations. CTL is proud to continue to host NASTEN partner agencies like DoD, NASA, NOAA, NSF, and NTIA to propel measurement science across the government and efficiently share resources. These partnerships, as well as our own testing projects, have led to a vast compendium of data for industry, academia, and other federal agencies. Rising to the needs of the global pandemic, our researchers are working with the FDA to deploy a simple software update which turns Wi-Fi routers into respiratory monitors using their communication signals. This will allow critical communities like long-term care facilities to monitor patients' respiratory function at no additional cost. And just like everyone else, we figured out how to do differently during the pandemic by modifying and expanding our spectrum monitoring program, collecting over 40 gigabytes of data to examine the impacts of COVID-19 on wireless spectrum availability in residential and healthcare settings. The outcomes of this project will help inform future 5G standards and capture real-world scenarios that industry can consider when testing new devices. Not only that, this virtual environment allowed us to include college and high school students from across Colorado to join in for a summer internship and grow our STEM workforce programs. Additionally, we also hosted a Tech to Protect challenge. This challenge led to 25 new apps created and 6 new companies formed to accelerate applications for public safety. The challenge included events in 10 cities, 10 unique technical contests, and over 20 supporting organizations. The winning innovation will help move our wildfire fighting efforts forward as it aims to improve the efficiency of delivering mission-critical communications by creating a system that stores, pauses, and replays messages both online and offline. This app could save precious time for first responders by eliminating the need to repeatedly ask for information. By connecting the public safety community with innovators, the result is moving technology from concept to commercialization. With the funding for our Innovation Accelerator program running out next year, we are looking forward to working with the Department of Commerce to secure resources to continue investing in American innovation through these important public-private partnerships. And I know that everybody on this call shares a passion for growing our STEM workforce. Here in Colorado, we're doing just that. We do that by investing with our partner agencies across the Front Range to participate in the grant-based professional research and experience program. So far, we've had over 220 prep participants at our Boulder facility, and we are looking to expand. In the next 18 months, NIST will issue a notice of funding opportunity announcement for universities to participate in the grant-based professional research and experience program. This program is designed to provide valuable laboratory experience and financial assistance to undergraduates, graduate students, postdocs, and faculty. And then additionally, we are doing work supporting climate change and environment as well. From monitoring to standards to international partnerships, NIST has longstanding programs to support the environment and tackle climate change. Next week's Destination Startup at CU is a collaboration among leading research universities and federal laboratories across the Rocky Mountain region. At this year's showcase, LongPath Technologies will be featured and represents an excellent example of NIST's crucial role in technology transfer to bring proof of concept to American innovation. Based on prize-winning dual-chrome laser technology from the PML Fiber Sources and Application Group and CU Boulder, LongPath is attacking the climate change problem of undetected methane emissions from active oil wells and by providing lowest cost, highest precision, continuous methane monitoring for oil field installations in the world. And then finally, leveraging this century-long partnership with the electric industry, we are collaborating with our partners to address this generation's grand challenge, modernizing the electrical power grid so that it can incorporate information technology to deliver electricity efficiency reliably, sustainably, and securely, and incorporate renewable energies as a critical source of energy. So with that, I want to thank you for the opportunity to discuss our efforts today and feel we are well positioned to aid in the new administration's efforts around climate crisis, spurring economic recovery, and delivering results in the race for 5G. I know that we've hosted you in the past, Congressman Neguse, and we look forward to hosting you again in the future. I really thank you for your time today and the opportunity to share some of the great accomplishments of our NIST team during this very challenging time. Thanks.
Well, thank you. This is Joe. I want to say thank you both for your very informative update and the updates from all of your colleagues. Very helpful for me and certainly probably learned more in this hour than I have in the last several weeks. So I am very grateful. And as always, thank you for providing such thorough updates with respect to the work that we can do in Washington to better support your efforts back home. I unfortunately have to jump off the call because I have a Judiciary Committee hearing that is going to be proceeding momentarily. But Carissa and Sally and Jill will remain. Of course, we'll look forward to following up on a couple of specific items that have been mentioned throughout today's call as we think about legislation that we'd like to introduce in the coming weeks and months. I, of course, look forward to visiting with all of you in person, hopefully sometime soon as we near the light at the end of the tunnel here with respect to the pandemic. But in the meantime, if there are other ways that our office can be helpful, anything from submitting specific requests to the new cabinet officials that will be confirmed momentarily, we hope, as was mentioned by Dan at the beginning and the outset of the call, the Secretary of Commerce and the Secretary of Energy, both of whom I think will be fabulous and will do a very good job. If there are other ways that we can be helpful to advocating for the interests of our labs, we hope that you'll let us know, and we know that you are not a shy bunch and that you'll certainly do that. So, again, my apologies that I have to step off the call, but our team will stay on. Thank you, Dan.
Great. Thank you very much, Congressman Neguse. And yes, we do have one more short presentation on rural broadband and 5G. We'll be following up with your team specifically on that topic. They've been asking about it. Thanks for your time.
And we are on and eager to hear the next speaker, and we'll take notes. So thank you so much
thank you.
For continuing.
So, Andy, I know we've unfortunately the congressman stepped away, but as I had mentioned to you on the side, his staff has been directed to really absorb as much as they can about this topic, and we'll likely have another follow-up specifically to go into more detail. But please, this is Andy Thiessen, the division chief with the Institute for Telecommunication Sciences. You're on.
Yes, thank you for that. And hopefully the slides that I provided will help with the note-taking effort, because I know how difficult it can be with people speed-talking through 5 minutes. So like Ann said, my name is Andrew Chase. I'm a division chief with the Institute for Telecommunication Sciences as part of NTIA. ITS is the nation's spectrum and communications laboratory, right? And we're the engineering arm that provides that direct, engineering support to NTIA's policymaking function, right? And its role in being the information and telecommunications policy advisors to the White House. I also lead inside of NTIA for 5G standards and research and development. And so what I'm going to focus on for the most part today is some of the ITS activities around 5G. ITS, for just a little bit of context, we work on both appropriated funding as well as funding that we get from other agencies to represent their interests. So agencies like Department of Homeland Security, Transportation, Defense, NOAA, NIST, and some others. I guess I would be remiss if I didn't say thank you for the increase in NTIA's base budget, specifically for ITS to build out our 5G test lab. Very appreciated. And I will talk briefly about that today, and you can see it in the slides. So ITS has a long history in working in telecommunications. We have decades of focus on spectrum-related issues like spectrum sharing, given NTIA's role as the regulator for federal spectrum users. Propagation models used around the globe are written into our DNA, foundationally based on Anita Longley and Phil Rice with what's called the irregular terrain model. And like I said, spectrum sharing is and all things propagation are written into our DNA, which, as you can imagine, I think makes our work in 5G just that much more interesting for us. So on slide two, 5G standards. So the Third Generation Partnership Project is the primary standards development organization for 5G technology. We have a team of engineers deployed across 3GPP and have had for years since back in 2011 when I led a team on behalf of the First Responder Network Authority to help FirstNet close the gaps in LTE at that time with what public safety's communications needs are. Now, we work with, obviously on NTIA's, interest in 5G, as well as representing the interests of the Department of Transportation and the Department of Defense. We also lead an inter-U.S. government collaboration effort around the 3GPP activities, because there's a number of different organizations within the government that have teams inside of 3GPP. Certainly NIST does, DHS, Department of Transportation, Justice, and some others. On slide three, you can see a little bit about what we're doing with our 5G testbed. So the primary focus for us right now, based on, a lot of the interest that we've seen from Congress is around this idea of 5G vendor diversity. And so you'll see this also in later slides where, there's an obvious awakening to the fact that the United States doesn't have a domestic infrastructure manufacturer in the 5G radio access network space. But there's also, similar concerns, around some of our regional adversaries and some of the steps that they've taken, right, to compete in this space relative to, the like-minded vendors that we have, with the likes of Ericsson, Nokia, and Samsung. So one of the things that we're working on doing based on the Secure 5G and Beyond Act is working on trying to enhance or increase 5G vendor diversity. And one of those things that we're specifically looking at is a technology called Open Radio Access Networks. And what this is fundamentally is if you can imagine, if you will, breaking up one of these mobile networks into three parts. You have your smartphones, you have the cell towers that you see driving around, and then you have a core network. So think big racks of computers, spread throughout the United States. And typically that cell tower, right, when you buy what's called the Node B, and I apologize for using my propeller head terms here, but When you buy one of those things, it's typically a black box, right? It's a proprietary piece of gear that you buy from one vendor, and they give you the whole kit. But there's been a movement by a number of operators, you know, certainly led by AT&T and others in the United States, to basically break apart that black box to allow for more vendor diversity, even inside just that component of a 5G system, to allow for them to mix and match, right, you know, vendors is, you know, in order to meet their specific needs wherever they happen to be deploying the capability. So this is called O-RAN, right? And so one of the things that we're looking at in particular is just how difficult is it actually to take instead of just buying, you know, one of these things from one vendor, you have to cobble it together with multiple vendors. And the O-RAN proponents, right, will say, you know, that this is easy, right, that people do it all the time, right, it's kind of old hat. But that's, you know, we're certainly looking to test that and find out just how difficult that actually is, and publish results on that and try to support, you know, both our infrastructure manufacturers that we may see popping up in the O-RAN space as well as our operators. Additionally, one of the things that O-RAN is intended to try to address is the fact that typically when you're mobile with your device and you transition from one vendor's radio access network component to another, sometimes that transition doesn't work very well. It works really well when you're staying with the same vendor, going from vendor A to vendor A, but transitioning from one to the other doesn't always work so well. And so we're going to test how well O-RAN-based components work in that transition. And then, you know, we're also going to be pulling through, because a lot of this capability is built on software, NTIA software bill of materials objectives, right, to make sure that anything that we're leveraging is code-based, right, we have, you know, as perfect of an accountability of where that source code comes from as possible throughout the network. So on slide 4, you can see, you know, a mild diagram of what we're going to be working on. I think one interesting thing here is, if you see in the upper right-hand corner, the over-the-air test range at Table Mountain. As you might be aware, NTIA manages Table Mountain, which is a radio quiet zone, one of two in the United States, where we do quite a bit of testing. And host a number of other agencies who do testing, you know, taking advantage of that environment as well. On slide 5, one of the recent initiatives that we've kicked off with the Department of Defense is what we're calling a 5G challenge, where DoD is specifically interested in trying to open up some of the interfaces that exist in, you know, again, that 5G system to allow for more vendor diversity. And really, they want to focus on getting to interoperability amongst some of these varied components, because when you start to break apart traditional pieces of a 5G network that were closed before, you know, getting to conformance with standards and interoperability amongst different vendors is key in order to leverage that technology. And so we're exploring, you know, what such a challenge may look like with a currently open notice of inquiry in the Federal Register. And, you know, we're working with DoD and planning what that looks like once we get the responses to that NOI. On slide 6, you know, as you are probably aware, in the NDAA that was passed in December, obviously a whole lot of things going on in the NDAA, but one thing in particular that affects NTIA was the creation of a program around, you know, grant program around open radio access networks. It's currently not appropriated, but I think the expectation was that this Congress would figure something out there. And so we're working, right, again, this gets back to that 5G vendor diversity space. And in this context, right, looking at open radio access networks and funding that, you know, with grants to try to stimulate that market creation. Slides 7 and 8, I'll get into kind of a broader outward-facing effort that NTIA is leading on right now. And vendor diversity as well, where we're working, you know, across the U.S. government, you're right, leading a 5G vendor diversity working group led by Jay Sheree in the Office of International Affairs, as well as Evelyn Remley, the Office of Policy Analysis and Development. But we're also looking to partner with other nations. And so we've had a number of conversations with like-minded governments around the globe, you know, for what their interests are in 5G vendor diversity. And we have specific actions out of the implementation plan for the Secure 5G and Beyond Act to lead, right, trying to connect, you know, government laboratories like ours with the equivalents of ITS in other countries, you know, so that we can not duplicate work as much as possible and try to share the burden of trying to see this industry, you know, get the appropriate government support that it needs. And so with that, happy to take any questions.
Great. Thank you, Andy. That's the reference to the slides that the Congressman's staff had received. Those are also on our website, and I described we'll put the recording of this call with our materials from all the different speakers today. And if listeners on the line now or anyone who's ended up catching this on demand, they'll be able to follow along at their convenience with those slides as they hear your description as an audio file. Jill, over to you just quick. I know we're over time, so we may not have too much more for comments, but I'll leave the last word to you.
Well, and I just want to thank you. This was just incredible, and as the congressman said, he learned more in this hour than in a while, and I certainly did as well. Thank you all for your dedication and hard work and just incredible talent that you bring. We are very, very grateful to be living in this district alongside you and to, you know, support you in any way we can. So thanks again. And thank you, Dan, for putting this together.
You're welcome. Thank you for the interest. We'll have the recording and more material on our website. Thanks, everyone on the call. You likely have given me your email address to be able to get on this call, so I'll be following up when we have all that material posted by sometime tomorrow morning. And thanks, everyone, for your support of science and research in Colorado. I look forward to catching up with you on another, perhaps it's virtual, online. Well, we'll get to lab tours again eventually post-COVID. But the next topic that we're looking to arrange will be around biosecurity issues and zoonotic diseases relative to not only COVID, but those types of similar threats and the research that's going on here in Colorado across the Centers for Disease Control, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the U.S. Geological Survey. Stay tuned. That will probably be later in February. Thanks, everybody. And if you need to reach me, again, my name is Dan Powers. You can email me at dan@co-labs.org. And I look forward to seeing you or hearing you on another call in the future. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Dan. Bye-bye.
Thanks, bye.
Thank you all.